going to read to you from John's Gospel, from chapter 4, verse 43, to the end of chapter 4. After the 2 days, he departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honour in his own town. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So he came to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judah to Galilee, he went to see him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked him the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, "Yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. A Christian is someone who belongs to Christ, who wants Christ for Christ. To become a Christian means that someone has seen something about Christ and come to him for that. The Westminster, well-known statement, the Westminster Short Catechism, question one and answer one. So this is our sort of church's doctrinal, you know, what we believe. Question one, what is the chief end of man? Answer, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. But that's not all of us or all of us all of the time, is it? Often we want Jesus for what we can get from him. He is not our chief end. He is often our chief means to another end, and that will lead to disappointment. Sometimes we want health, a relationship, comfort, success on our terms. It may even be we want something spiritually good. We want to grow the church massively, whatever it is, but it's on our terms. We want to do that, and Jesus is the means. He seems a good route to possibly a good end that we may have. There are other ways that he is not the chief end. Familiarity. We've lost the shock factor of the gospel and of Jesus. We read some Bible passages, we're not shocked in the way we were. That we're no longer surprised by Jesus. He should be continually surprising us. We've lost the sense of awe and wonder, and so it doesn't lead us into worship in quite the same natural response that we may have once. We're just not excited anymore. Another way is presumption. We feel entitled to things from God. So how might we respond to Jesus, good or bad? We find here at the end of John 4. Jesus draws our attention not so much to the responses to him, although they're important, because to some degree or another, these are our responses. But ultimately, he draws our attention to Jesus Christ, that would be filled with awe as to who he is and what he's like. So, but we'll look at these responses because that exposes that. So the first response is, I've called a conditional welcome in verses 43 to 48. A conditional welcome, a welcome that isn't really a welcome, a receiving Christ that is not really receiving Christ. Notice there's an odd sequence of events. I found this quite odd when I first started reading it. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 42 was Jesus in a village in Samaria. He has a conversation with a woman, and she goes to the village, and there's a massive response from her and the villagers. A positive response to Jesus. And then verse 43, after 2 days, he goes to Galilee. Why does he do that? Well, in verse 44, it says, because a prophet has no honour in his hometown. So why leave this place Sychar in Samaria? Huge positive response to Jesus. Why does he go there? To rejection. Not even to uncertainty, but to likely rejection. If I go from here to there, I will be not honoured. Stranger gets to verse 45, so next verse, and it says, and they welcomed him. So where's the problem? So he said, so he goes from a place where they honour him, saying, I'm going to go to a place where they're not going to honour him. Fairly strange. But they welcome him. So it looks like they're happy with it. But the welcome is conditional. Why? Well, look at why they welcome him. In the end of verse 45, it says, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. Now, that takes us back to end of chapter 2. So chapter 2, verse 23, and to the end of the chapter, I'll read it to you. So this is after first half of chapter 2, the wedding and the water to wine. Then second half, he cleanses the temple. He chucks the tables over and stuff. And the chapter ends. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them, because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. Now, I only touched on those verses then, but people seem to believe because of the signs. But Jesus didn't entrust himself to them. Why? Well, why did they come to Jesus? They came to Jesus because of the signs, not because of Jesus himself. And this comes up again in chapter 7. And in verse 5, we read, not even his brothers believed in him. So remember, right back at the start, before Christmas, John sets out his stall in that sort of quite grand introduction in chapter 1. And chapter 1, verse 11, it says, his own received him not. The ones that should have known best, even his own family, at least initially, missed who he is. And actually, Jesus tells us as much that here. Jesus' comments sort of unlock those odd few verses we've just alluded to. He comes to the context as he comes to Cana, where the first sign was, the water into wine, at the wedding in chapter 2, and then on to Capernaum, I think about 12 miles away. And an official comes to him with an ill son. We'll come back to them in a moment. And Jesus says in verse 48, he says, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. He says that in a with a tone of criticism. But notice the use there, as you can't see in most English translations, if you have an old one, the use there are plural. Use lot. So Jesus is not speaking to the dad specifically, but to all of the people who are there. But he's using the dad's request as an opportunity to address this issue. Jesus is drawing their attention to their attitude. They welcome him, but they don't honour him. They welcome him, but they don't give him glory. One of John's favourite words. So Jesus comes and they're polite. They welcome Jesus. It's nice to hear what you've got to say. Nice to have you here with us. Contrast that with the other encounters where people fall down and give him glory. The difference isn't there between honouring someone and welcoming someone. So they like Jesus. They like him because he does miracles and he heals. Good bloke to have around. He's a good means to an end. But from time to time, the response to him is negative from those who know him best. Who is this man? We know his mum and his dad. They knew the dates between their wedding and his birth wouldn't have quite tallied. They knew his brothers and sisters. They went to school with him and to synagogue. There's nothing special about him. He's one of us. It's familiarity again. And presumptions. Here is Jesus to fix my problem. Jesus, my problem, fix it. And then anger, if not, at least disappointment. Even pride. Jesus, oh yes, yeah. We're from the same town. We have a desire. Everyone has a desire to be connected to someone and something special. And of course, as we've already thought, there are Christian versions of those, aren't there? So externally and formally, they give a welcome to Jesus. Jesus is quite welcome in our lives and in the church if he's being useful, doing as he's told, if he's not interrupting, if he's not meeting my expectation, if he's getting in the way. You heard, I've tried Christianity, but it didn't work. But what were you trying to make it do? And in that statement, who is the boss? Who's setting the boundaries and the conditions there? It's the wrong way round, isn't it? We have it all the wrong way round at that point. But it's all totally understandable. So that's the Galilean's response. Now we have a contrast there of a surprising faith in verse 47 onwards. So contrast between the Galileans, this conditional welcome, and this official. Now, sometimes people muddle this up with other bits of the Bible because there's a similar but different account in Matthew 8 and Luke 7. There's a Roman officer whose servant is ill, and Jesus heals him from a distance. It's slightly different. It's a son, not a servant, but also notice it doesn't say Roman or officer. It says official. And the Greek word there actually derives from the word king, so a royal one, we might say. And almost certainly, this would be someone, an official, a dignitary from the court of Herod Antipas, who had a residence or palace nearby these events. And he's heard and he's come. Now, the Herods, there were six Herods over the span of the New Testament, there are six Herods. And it's like a dynasty of Herods. And I think actually only five are mentioned, but there are six of them, and they're all bad. They all had their special, unique way of being bad. They're not proper kings, for a start. They're not Jewish, far less are they Davidic, along with the line of David, as the Jewish king should be. They were placed there by the Romans. They're not kings in any real meaningful sense. So they're a bit like Samaritans. They're sort of half and half. They had some idea of the culture and of the religion. They may have had some Jewish blood, although not royal blood. But they're not really of the right sort. And they're definitely baddies. And this is one of their officials. So one from this court has come to Jesus, and his motive is clear. His son is ill and needs healing. In fact, at the end of verse 47, at the point of death. He's desperate. And so it's clear why he goes to Jesus. The reason is, my son is ill, please heal him. Not, I've sinned, please forgive me. But it's all understandable. And when Jesus comments about, well, they just want a sign, the dad, verse 49, just repeats. He doesn't debate, he just repeats, this is my desperate need. The man's request is simple. He says, come. The reason is simple. You do miracles. My son is ill. If we can get you together, problem solved. Come. He has a need, but Jesus does not come to respond to you. And so you get this shocking thing in verse 50. Shocking in a couple of ways, I think. Jesus said to him, go. Your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him, and went on his way. And shockingly, there's no explanation. Nothing about what will happen next. Look, if you do this, then this. He just says, go. Not, I'm coming with you. Go, and your son will live. And more shocking, the dad did it. He went on his way. There's no questions, no buts, no argument. There's no pleading anymore. There's a gear change from this desperate man. There's no sign of a miracle yet. He takes Jesus at his word. Now contrast the rest. They just want a miracle. Jesus doesn't show him one at this point. He just says, take me at my word. But it's not where the story ends, of course. In verses 51 to 53, he goes home and a servant comes out to meet him with the news that the boy's been healed. He asks him the time, and he can work out that that's just when Jesus said those words. And they all believe, the whole household believes. So notice he believed in Jesus and went home. And then at home, he really believed Jesus, him and the rest of the household. And that's what faith is, taking Jesus at his word. It's not irrational. It's not without any evidence at all, but it is not the proof as I demand it when I demand it on my terms. Faith takes Jesus at his word, but the promise outcome is delayed. For the official, it's one day. For us, normally, it's longer. So we trust Jesus, we obey his commandments and how we do life, including obeying him how we do church and mission. And the fruit of that, generally, is not seen at the time. It's not we do something obedient and there's a reward. There's revival or something. Normally, the fruit is not seen for quite some time, sometimes not in our lifetime. And of course, you think on the big scale, the big promise, we're not seen until we're in the new creation. Jesus says to you, trust me, obey me, and wait for the outcome. Again, here, the one who gets it is the one you'd least expect, the one who's biblically illiterate, the baddie. Even his approach to Jesus isn't quite right. He doesn't come asking for forgiveness or recognizing who Jesus is. He's got it all wrong. But actually, in the end, he's the only one who gets it. And so again, in John, the theme is, keep on getting this, don't we, is look to Jesus. So the passage is about him, really. It's not so much about the official or the Galileans, but through these characters, we see Jesus' identity and his power and his grace. And those things are tied together. His power, he heals at a distance. The official, often he heals close up. I suppose that shows the relationship between the person, Jesus, and the person he's healing. Often his healings, although they're a sign of his compassion, they're also often making a point about his identity and what he's come to do. But here, he does it at some distance. And of course, it could be any distance. He could have done it on another planet. He could have done it across the world. He doesn't need to be in close proximity to do it. It doesn't matter. But to see his power, to give us a clue as to who he is, that he is the one with authority over life and death by his word, which takes us back to chapter 1. Who is he? Well, he is the one who is the word that's come flesh. He's the eternal God, the Son. And notice how the chapter ends. It talks about the second sign that he did. Now, we've been told into chapter 2 already, he's done lots of signs. So not just chapter 2, he's done lots of signs. Also, not been told what they were in John. John doesn't always number the signs, but he's numbered the first two, the water into wine, and then this one. And the point is, Jesus has done lots and lots of signs, but I'm just going to tell you about a few. I'm going to tell you about a few to draw a particular attention about how these signs, and he uses the word sign rather than miracle, these signs point us to his identity so that you know who he is, that Jesus is the Christ, that he is eternal God come in the flesh. And so with that, we see his grace. In the chapter 4, Jesus is rejecting the concept that he's here to do miracles on demand. He goes, I'm not here to do miracles because you ask for them. He rebukes sign seeking. And what does he do? He gives a sign. He gives a healing. But why does he do that? If he's rejecting sign seeking, why does he do it? Well, because he's so compassionate. Also, it's grace to this official. What do we know about him? Not much, but they have no prior relationship. He is a baddie. He approaches Jesus on the wrong basis. He hasn't come recognizing who Jesus is or asking for his sins to be forgiven. He just wants this one outcome, his son to be healed. He's not looking for the right thing. He's not done anything good to merit this response from Jesus. All he does is take Jesus at his word. This is pure grace from Jesus. And that too points us to his identity. Notice we get this line in the Bible. Power and grace come together. In the Old Testament, see God's power and grace come together, and specifically in the New Testament in Jesus. They come hand to hand. He uses his power often to show his grace to the undeserving. If Jesus were just power, he would be quite frightening. We've seen what happens with the limited power that a dictator has. They're frightening. If it was just grace, he would be wet. He'd be well-meaning, but a bit pathetic and ineffectual. But what we see is both are acting together. And so his call to you is, go and trust me. Whoever you are, wherever you are, whatever background, you've been approaching him all wrong, doesn't matter now. Look to him. Not to demand Jesus on your terms. He's there not to meet your needs, so to speak. But when you come to Jesus for Jesus, early in chapter 4, he talks about the living water. Do you remember to the woman at the well? He talked about this living water that quenches your real thirst. The thirst that kind of all other thirsts are a subset of. When you go to Jesus for Jesus, he meets that deepest need. Just we're not very good at identifying what our deepest need is. When we go to Jesus for Jesus, he meets that need. When we go to Jesus for other stuff, it leads to disappointment. We often do a verse of the year. I was greedy this year. Two, we need twice the encouragement. But a few years ago, we had Psalm 37, verse 4. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. Now, he's not saying there that God gives you what you want. If what you want is, well, desires of my heart, I'd like a better car, I'd like a Caribbean holiday, or whatever it is. But he's saying, if you want God, if God is the foremost in your heart, if you delight in him, then he gives you your heart's desire, because he is your heart's desire. When you desire Jesus, guess what you get? You get him. He doesn't hide. So why do we come to Jesus as a means, not an end? Because we feel he is no longer enough. He is enough. And he's more than enough. So John Forrest contrasts these two responses, but also leaves us looking to Jesus, at his power and his grace. That is, he uses both for you. And we see his power, his awe, his beauty, his love, and the care of Jesus, that he cares deeply for his people. So much so, he takes your sins at the cross and gives forgiveness, and by his Spirit, this ongoing transformation, while he gives you this living water, this fellowship with him that lasts till we come home, that home of eternal life. So come to him and trust him, and there we find what we actually need.